May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Christopher Glinsky, and I represent the appellant, Philip Rucker, in this criminal appeal. We contend that the District Court erred when it precluded evidence of a year 2000 conviction of theft of public funds for a crucial government witness, Sheila Chandler. Mr. Rucker was charged with wire fraud, and he was convicted after a jury trial. The allegation was that Mr. Rucker, Jerry Heyman, and Sheila Chandler, among others, were involved in a mortgage fraud scheme. And the government alleged specifically that Mr. Rucker was involved because he told buyer Lequitter Smith to sign a gift letter that turned out to be fraudulent. And that's why Sheila Chandler's testimony at the trial was so important. She, in fact, testified that it was Mr. Rucker's idea to come up with this fraudulent letter that was supposedly from Ms. Smith's brother, indicating that he was giving her $4,000 as a down payment on a home at 3758 Buchanan Street. And Chandler's testimony was really the only testimony indicating that Mr. Rucker directly participated in this scheme knowingly and with intent to defraud when he engaged in this mortgage fraud scheme. Now, when Rucker's trial attorney saw how important Chandler's testimony was, he sought to introduce a year 2000 conviction for theft of public funds, and Rucker's trial attorney sought to admit that prior conviction because, while on the stand, Ms. Chandler testified that she had begun lying and creating false documents in 2004, when in fact the conviction from the year 2000 would have shown that she actually began engaging in that type of behavior 4 years earlier. So this would have been powerful impeachment evidence against Ms. Chandler after she had in fact testified under oath that her dishonest behavior began in 2004. Now, under Federal Rule of Evidence 609, evidence of a conviction over 10 years old is admissible only if its probative value, supported by specific facts and circumstances, substantially outweighs its prejudicial effect. Now, here, the court appeared to not use any discretion when it decided that evidence of this 2000 conviction was not going to be allowed. In a pretrial motion, after hearing arguments, the judge simply granted the government's motion in limine to preclude reference to the conviction. And then during trial, when the issue was brought up again, the judge, without elaboration, simply indicated that he did not feel that the probative value substantially outweighed its prejudicial effect.
Didn't he signal that she had just admitted to 11 other wire fraud convictions?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that would
Isn't that fairly transparent as to what the judge was thinking?
Well, that would
that,
go
that,
to
that, that this rare and exceptional practice of using an older conviction would really have very little additional probative value.
Well, Your Honor, the issue with that is the 11 convictions all stemmed from very recent cases. In fact, both of those cases that made up the 11 counts were open at the time this trial was going on. And those really, I think, when the judge talked about the 11 convictions, he was talking about prejudice. And when you look at the transcript from the motion hearing prior to trial on the motion in limine, the assistant United States attorney trying the case essentially admitted that there was no prejudice. So the thing I think that makes this case different and the reason we're arguing that discretion was abused here is because of the specific fact that Ms. Chandler did testify that she began lying in the year 2004, and that testimony was under oath. So aside from the 11 convictions that she did admit to, and those were all recent convictions in currently open cases, she provided further testimony, and the 2000 conviction certainly would have been very probative of her credibility, given the fact that she testified under oath untruthfully, and also given the fact that in the year 2000, she gets caught engaging in this dishonest behavior. She gets put on 5 years of probation, and then in 2004, she's right back doing the same thing. And another thing that's interesting here is there was testimony at the trial about the plea agreement that Ms. Chandler had entered into, and Ms. Chandler testified that in order to gain a benefit for her cooperation, all she had to do was tell the truth in this case. And the fact that she said in 2004 she began lying when, in fact, there's evidence that that occurred much before that would show that she, in fact, was not being truthful, despite the fact that she had a lot to lose. And she tried to present to the jury that she was fully cooperating and telling the truth about everything.
How do you distinguish this situation from United States versus Gray? In Gray, the convictions during the 10-year window did not involve dishonest acts, and the remote conviction was for perjury. In this case, it's even a more serious situation because the 10-year window did involve dishonest acts.
Right, Your Honor. In Gray, the case involved perjury, but the court made clear it wasn't perjury in court. It was actually perjury. The court didn't specifically identify what the perjury was, but it had to do with providing false information on a driver's license in California. So I think the fact that it was perjury may be overstating it a bit. It was different than that. In addition, the court in that case said that the defendants in that case were allowed to impeach the co-defendant with evidence that he committed an offense while he was on parole as well. Obviously, that would be strong evidence. In this case, Mr. Rucker's attorney was not allowed to do that.
Let me ask you, what does X to argument mean?
I don't know. That's a term I'm not familiar with.
No, it's in the...
I know it's in the transcript. I'm not familiar with what it actually means, but based on the context, I would assume it means, do you have some support for the argument that you're making? But I'm not familiar with it.
Well, you don't know either then, huh?
I do not. So, and then the argument was made by the government in its reply brief that this was harmless error, but it's not harmless error because Rucker had a defense in this case. His defense was not implausible if the jury did not believe Ms. Chandler's testimony. There was no overwhelming evidence against Mr. Rucker. The evidence was circumstantial, and all of that evidence...
The evidence of witness Smith.
Yes.
What about that evidence, the government says?
The evidence that Ms. Smith's testimony really can all be explained by Mr. Rucker being duped in this fraudulent scheme. She had mentioned a number of things. She testified that she only saw the outside of the house, but her testimony was also that she was going to use this as a rental property. There was also testimony that this property was in a very good area. It was near shopping. It was near a school. It was near public transportation as well, so it would be attractive to renters. Also, when Ms. Smith went to look at this home, there were actually people living inside it, so I think it would be fair for her to assume that this house must be habitable if some people are, in fact, living in it at the time. Now, I see that I'd like to... rebuttal time.
I just have one question. What were the specific facts and circumstances that are supposed to support the probative value that were provided in this case?
The specific facts and circumstances that were argued by Mr. Rucker's attorney were that this was a year 2000 conviction, it was for theft of public funds, and that's basically all the information we have. We also know she was placed on probation for 5 years, but when you take that and you compare it to the fact that Ms. Chandler testified that in 2004 she began this behavior, that's why it becomes so significant, because this prior conviction, even though we don't know a lot more about it than what the conviction was for, what the specific crime alleged is, it strongly indicates that she was being untruthful in her testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Marcisi.
May it please the Court, my name is John Machezik. I'm an Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Indiana. I represent the government in this case, and I ask the Court to affirm the judgment of the District Court. I want to start off by answering the question that Judge Kapala asked about acts in the record. Do you have anything to axe to the to your argument. I think that was a transcription of, do you have anything to add to your argument?
Add, yes.
That's my best guess. I wasn't there, but that's what I believe.
Thank you.
And I also want to mention that a couple of things that were mentioned by the attorney for appellant. The assistant U.S. attorney did not concede in the original argument regarding the motion in limine that there was no prejudice. Specifically, he said, I'm not so certain there's any prejudice here, but is the question, does it substantially outweigh? Now, he didn't go into that any further. And I have to tell you also that transcript of that hearing was just recently added to the record below, just yesterday. And that's why you may not have it in the record before you.
This is on the motion in limine?
On the motion in limine, yes. And that argument occurred prior to the jury selection. And for some reason, it was left out of the record on appeal. But that's what the assistant U.S. attorney said in that. And that was just posted, docketed yesterday by the court reporter.
Well, let's get straight to it. What was the prejudicial effect here?
Well, the prejudicial effect is the same thing that the court in United States versus Heath mentioned, which is that simply presenting cumulative evidence. The district court judge has the ability to manage the case and determine when something is unnecessarily cumulative. And that's what this court said in United States versus Heath. And as you know from both Heath and from
Greg. But there were 11 convictions. What's one more?
Well, that's to the extent that you're talking about, that's correct. But there is the prejudicial effect is cumulative evidence. And that's the same thing that the court in Heath was talking about in that case. There were 9 convictions in that case, and the court said, I'm not going to allow you to go into any additional ones outside the 10-year conviction. 9 convictions are 10-year winner. 9 convictions are enough.
How many more additional convictions were there in Heath?
I think they were arguing for one additional, Your Honor, and I'm not positive. Oh, a few additional theft convictions in that case.
All right. Well, here we have one.
That's right. We have one. But it's still the cumulative evidence is the issue. And furthermore, there is a – you have to – the prism of this case is, did he abuse his discretion in this case? And there is a asymmetrical balancing test that the district court must apply. Did the probative value substantially outweigh the prejudicial effect? And I admit the prejudicial effect in this case of cumulative evidence is not that heavy, but there is very little probative value either in this case. You've got 11 additional convictions, 11 convictions that Ms. Chandler had said that she had pled guilty to, 2 in this case, in fact, the specific count that was involved in this case, 9 in another case. And throughout her testimony, she admits that she had been involved in lying with regard to mortgage fraud for an extended period of time.
Okay, but didn't she say she stopped lying in 2004?
She said she started lying in 2004.
Started lying in 2004.
Started lying in 2004.
And this happened before 2004, so why isn't that very probative?
Well, we don't know exactly what was involved. I mean, there are different types of fraud. The fraud that was involved in the 2000 conviction may not have technically involved lying. I don't know what the circumstances were. That's the burden of the proponent of the evidence to show that the court that that was indeed another instance of her lying. Certainly, it's another instance of her being dishonest, but we don't know if there was actual lying involved. And I think it's kind of a splitting hairs. The bottom line is she testified throughout the entire direct testimony, her entire direct testimony about numerous instances of her committing fraud, lying, cheating, and then on cross-examination, she admitted that she had she was in fact a liar. Succinctly, that's what she said, and she also admitted that the objective of this plan was to steal. So the jury certainly had plenty of evidence to show that, to treat her testimony with care. Her testimony was corroborated. She was not the linchpin witness in this case. LaQuiter Smith was the one that testified about how she had been shepherded, recruited, promised $10,000, shepherded through this process. And what she said was supported by or supported Chandler's testimony. She never spoke with Chandler regarding her mortgage application. That all went through Mr. Rucker. She never met Chandler. Her only conversation with Chandler throughout this application process was one telephone call concerning getting a fax number where she could fax a bank statement, I think, and that was it. Rucker was the go-between between her and Sheila Chandler for this entire process. And Smith also never met Jerry Heyman. Or she didn't recall meeting him. He was actually at the closing. But Rucker was her conduit for this whole thing. And finally, I mean, I don't want to go into what's in the brief, but the evidence was very strong against Mr. Rucker. Who could possibly think that on a house, even if it's valued at the inflated price of $85,000, that it was possible to pull $30,000 out of that transaction to distribute to himself, to Chandler, and to Smith? Unless the court has any further questions, I will. A long time ago, I clerked for Judge Ruggiero Aldisert, and he said, attorneys should know when to shut up and sit down. So,
not constitutionally mandated to use all your time.
Pardon me?
Not constitutionally mandated to use all your time.
Well, yes. But I believe that the cases of Heath and Gray control the outcome in this case of standard of review and the test that the district court had to apply. He did not abuse his discretion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Linsky?
Thank you, Your Honor. The government argued that Ms. Chandler's testimony was corroborated by Ms. Smith, but it was not corroborated on one significant point, and that significant point is the gift letter. Ms. Smith's testimony was simply that Mr. Rucker brought her a packet of documents. Mr. Rucker's testimony was that he got a packet of documents, he didn't look through them. Ms. Chandler's testimony was much different. Her testimony was that Mr. Rucker, in fact, called her and said, hey, let's make this fake gift letter. You type it up. I'll go take it over to Ms. Smith and have her sign it, showing that he knew what this document was, and, in fact, it was his idea. Now, without Ms. Chandler's testimony, it leaves circumstantial evidence that Mr. Heyman was a successful real estate person who promised Mr. Rucker $10,000, and that's why he was engaged with Ms. Smith.
What about Mr. Machasek's point that this remote conviction for theft or bribery concerning programs receiving federal funds may not involve lying?
Well, it involves theft. It involves dishonest behavior, and
But she said that she didn't say I'm not involved. I didn't get involved in dishonest behavior until 2004. She said I didn't start lying until 2004.
Well, the question was whether when she personally became involved in activity where she would lie on behalf of buyers or create false documents.
All right, but this
and
isn't
that's
that.
What she said was
this isn't that. Theft or bribery concerning programs receiving federal funds is not that.
Well, it could be. I mean, it's theft beginning in 2000, the dishonest behavior beginning in 2000, contrary to her testimony in 2004.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Glinski, I want to give you an additional thanks from the court for accepting this appointment. Case taken under advisement.